The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to your Senior Chapman pod on The Athletic. Along with David, I'm joined today by The Athletic's Adam Crafton and Jack Pitt-Brook. Coming up, a difficult week, both on and off the field for Tottenham, was capped off by yesterday's defeat to Manchester City in the League Cup final. So what is the plan now for the club and for Daniel Levy? We'll continue our look at how the England squad is shaping up ahead of Euro 2020 as well, and our focus will be on Phil Foden. Don't forget, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. All you've got to do, go to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. Well, I think the majority of this pod then is going to be dominated by Tottenham because, Jack, it feels like they have more issues than probably any other Premier League club going into this summer. Would you agree?
I think so, yeah. Almost everything is on the table this summer with Daniel Levy and Spurs. They've got huge decisions to make about their players. They haven't got a manager. They don't know what European competition they'll be playing in next season. They're facing a new round of unpopularity, a new wave of unpopularity from the fans after the Super League attempt. The Tottenham Hotspur Supporters Trust have called for the resignation of the executive board and the replacement with a new board with fan representation. It's a difficult time in terms of the finances, as it is for many Premier League clubs, but especially Spurs. They're very financially reliant on filling the new stadium, which they haven't been able to do because of COVID. So it's tough. It's, you know, Daniel Levy's got a huge set of decisions to make this summer, and it's really anyone's guess what Tottenham will look like in next season and beyond.
Jack, just while you're on the subject of Daniel Levy, it wasn't so long ago that Spurs were opening their new stadium and he was giving guided tours and interviews and he was being hailed as the man who has led Spurs into the new era. And now there is really simmering sort of discontent among large sections of the Spurs fan base. Does that show how quickly the atmosphere can change around him, or is it now at the point of no return?
I don't think it is the point of no return, just because I don't think he's going to go anywhere. I don't think there is any prospect of him doing an Ed Woodward and stepping down over the events of the last week. I do think he's been very unfortunate in the sense that nobody could have predicted COVID, and the Tottenham business model was built on building this fantastic new stadium, which is one of the best stadiums in Europe, filling it with football every week, filling it with non-football when there's not football on, and making a lot of money that way. And obviously, they haven't had a full Tottenham Hotspur stadium since early March 2020. So in that sense, he's been unlucky. At the same time, he has also made mistakes. You know, Jose Mourinho was a mistake. Signing up for the Super League was a mistake. That's really damaged relationships, I think, with the fans. You can tell some of the players are disaffected by recent events, and that's why everything is piling up in his intro, basically, and he's got a lot of big decisions to make.
Is Levy the lightning rod for the fans as opposed to Enoch and Joe Lewis, or are they both equally culpable in the minds of the fans?
I think both equally culpable in the minds of the fans. So I was at the game last Wednesday where Spurs beat Southampton 2-1, and outside there were lots of banners which were saying Enoch out, Levy out. You know, they know that Daniel Levy has worked for Enoch for even longer than Enoch have owned Tottenham. Him and Joe Lewis are obviously incredibly close. You know, through Enoch, Daniel Levy owns a bit of Tottenham. Like, there's no prospect of Daniel Levy going without Enoch going. You know, the only way that Daniel Levy would go is if Enoch were to sell. And even if they did sell, there is some talk that Levy might stay on as a CEO for under a new ownership. So in that sense, I think fans calling for Levy and Enoch to just step away are going to be disappointed.
I wonder, Adam, whether Enoch see Levy as a bit of a shield at times for them.
It's incredibly useful for them. I was thinking, it was actually last week when we were working on all the Super League stuff, and maybe I am just a really poorly informed journalist, but I was just thinking, I don't know what Joe Lewis looks like. I'm going to Google image Joe Lewis, because he has been incredibly disguised over the years by Daniel Levy, who everyone, you know, when everyone thinks of Tottenham and you think of who's the powerful person, no one, I think, outside of the Tottenham fan base generally thinks about Joe Lewis. So it then became quite interesting to try and work out, well, during these discussions over the Super League, was Joe Lewis involved in this? You know, how much say did he have in this? We know Daniel Levy was doing all the discussions, but, you know, I think we've also now worked out that Joe Lewis does have a relationship with people like the Glazers and Kroenke and FSG. Like, he's been at different parties with them over the years in the States. So he's been an incredibly useful shield. It certainly wouldn't be in Joe Lewis's interest for Daniel Levy to step down, because all of a sudden you then start scrutinizing the higher level decision making to a far greater extent, much in the same way as I think Joel Glazer is about to get a big shock when Ed Woodward's no longer at the club.
And yeah, do Enoch then, does Joe Lewis, Jack, say to Daniel Levy, what on earth were you doing appointing Jose Mourinho?
I think ultimately Levy is able to run the football club more or less as he wants. They have Lewis has trusted Levy to run Enoch and his football investments since the mid-1990s. You know, that's really the origin story of Enoch's ownership of Spurs, has been when Lewis found the kind of young 30-something investor and banker and retail expert Levy and decided to let him be his sort of protege, basically, and to run all the Enoch stuff for him. So they have an incredibly tight working relationship. Levy's been working for Lewis for almost 30 years now. And that's why I think that the prospect of Lewis moving Levy aside, even over a mistake like the Super League or a mistake like Mourinho, I think is very, very unlikely. You know, the two men are extremely close.
Chuck, do you think there's been... I look at, for example, Southampton a few years ago, where they had this fantastic model of buying young players, selling them at the right time, scouting really well, getting the next raft of young players in. And I sort of saw Spurs slightly similar to that, in that every single decision they made, whether it was over a coach or recruitment, because it was so tight in order to be sustainable, they had to get it spot on. And really, he's just made two or three big mistakes over a couple of years now. But it's almost like he's got 80% of the decisions right over the last 5 to 7 years, and it's just two or three big ones that have cost him. Is that unfair? Or
I think you're right that for Tottenham to be competing with Chelsea and City, which is ultimately what they want to do, given that they have much less money to spend than Chelsea and City, because Joe Lewis, unlike Abu Dhabi or Roman Abramovich, is not in the habit of injecting lots of extra money into the club, that means they basically have no margin for error. And that means if you appoint a Pochettino and you sign the right young players and everything, you build it in the right way, you can get really, really close. But all it takes, as you say, is one or two mistakes. You know, failing to back Pochettino in 2017, failing in 2018, not signing Jack Grealish in 2018, replacing Pochettino with Mourinho. Then COVID happens, and all of a sudden, your margin for error is gone. Whereas the beauty, if that's the right word, of being, say, Manchester City or Chelsea, is you can make mistake after mistake after mistake and you'll still be really, really good. And Tottenham don't really have that luxury. And that's why I do have a lot of sympathy for Daniel Levy, because even though he hasn't been perfect, he's operating almost as well as he can do in an incredibly difficult marketplace.
David?
I was going to shift it on to matters on the field. And a question that was sort of on my mind that doesn't feel like it's been addressed, Jack, since Ryan Mason was put in temporary charge. Why was it Mason that Daniel Levy trusted with running the team post-Mourinho on an interim basis, and not the more experienced likes of Ledley King, who was part of the Jose Mourinho setup, but it is, of course, a Tottenham legend and also more senior in the coaching world than Ryan Mason, and also Chris Powell, who's a vastly experienced manager who was also already in the building?
That's a really, really interesting question, David. And I've heard that quite a lot in the last week or two. Lots of people, you know, in coaching circles have asked why it is Mason who's got the top job and not more experienced people. My best guess would be that maybe Mason, because he was recently a player, he played for this Tottenham team only 3 years ago or 4 years ago, might have closer relationships with some of the players involved. He might be seen as the right man, as a kind of post-Mourinho soother, like a lozenge, who can just, you know, kind of cajole the players back into smiling again and playing the right way. But you're right, on an experience level, you know, Mason is 29 years old. He's obviously got less experience of coaching than, say, Chris Powell, who's managed throughout the Football League. And I understand why people feel that way.
It was interesting that I think Harry Redknapp in a column on Sunday said very strongly that Daniel Levy has an appointment lined up and that he won't be able to get him until the end of the season. And that's why the appointment has been put back until the summer, and Ryan Mason has been placed in interim charge to hold the fort.
Is it Harry? He can't get out of his TV show with Jamie until the summer.
Well, maybe. I'm sure back. He'll wind his window down and give us a bit of insight on that. But my sort of understanding, and from reading the work of others, was that no, on this occasion, unlike in all previous occasions, which is what Harry's referring to there, because it happened with him personally, and we saw it with Pochettino into Mourinho, etc. that they haven't got somebody lined up and they're running a proper process this time because they have to get it right. And I know we say that each time, but it feels like Tottenham have gone in the sort of two different extremes in Pochettino and then Mourinho. The discontent, the situation around the finances, the stadium, the continued wait for silverware, they really have to nail this one. And perhaps that's why they genuinely are running a thorough process and looking at a number of candidates.
Yeah, I completely agree, David. Spurs are at the start of the process. That's why I don't think we will get any announcement anytime soon. Daniel obviously needs to go away and come up with a shortlist and speak to all the candidates. But I think because of how badly, in relative terms, the last 2 years have gone for Spurs, you know, they've fallen out of the Champions League places. There's question marks over the futures of lots of their players. The squad, yet again, I think needs a bit of a refresh. That's why they do have to get this one right, because then they're no longer a Champions League team whose worst case scenario is slipping down into the Europa League. They're now a Europa League team and their worst case scenario is slipping down to eighth. Like, Spurs are currently seventh, and there's no guarantee that next year they will instantly bounce up to be fourth, because the fact is that the top, you know, the biggest teams are spending more and more money and getting better. And frankly, other teams like Leicester and West Ham have shown this year that they can be better than Tottenham, which would never have been the case 2 or 3 years ago. So it's a huge pressure moment for Tottenham.
And they've got a problem this summer in that I think financial fair play regulations are going to be relaxed a little bit. And that just gives an opportunity for, you know, Chelsea, Manchester City, Manchester United, if they get their recruitment right, which is absolutely not a guarantee. You know, the thing that has given Spurs a chance over the last few years has not only been their own competence, but the incompetence of other clubs around them. And that's quite a precarious business model, that you have to be 100% correct all the time and hope that others around you slip up all the time. So I do think even with, you know, whoever the next manager is or the next coach is, there does have to be a little bit of a realignment of expectations for Spurs. Like, a couple of years ago, we were talking about them as title contenders. I don't think it's realistic to expect that at all from the next manager. For the next manager, it's if he can come forth, that's an amazing season. And I think that's probably a difficult headspace for some Spurs fans to get themselves back into, to almost return to where they were just after Harry Redknapp.
Just on the new managers as well, is the money there, Jack, for their target? I mean, if you would have thought they could well be looking at people in work, if you believe the rumours, and people in work at very well-run clubs who are going to charge a pretty penny if Tottenham want their manager. And by that, I obviously mean either Leipzig or Leicester, as their managers are being linked with it. I mean, they're not going to be cheap. In COVID, with money tight, having paid a massive amount of money to get Mourinho off the books and Pochettino off the books until he then got his Paris Saint-Germain job.
Yeah, there is not a lot of money to go around at the moment, as particularly when you've changed managers twice in the last 18 months. And especially, you know, there were reports in Germany last night saying that Bayern Munich have made their official approach for Julian Nagelsmann. If so, that would look as if Spurs, you know, probably the best target or one of the most popular targets and someone who Spurs have looked at in the past would be slipping away from them. And then I imagine the next most popular target with Spurs fans would be Brendan Rodgers. Obviously, Brendan Rodgers signed a big new deal at Leicester after Arsenal approached him a few years ago. He would, I'm sure, be very expensive to get out of Leicester, even if he even wanted the Tottenham job. So in that sense, it is going to be very tough. You know, recruiting a manager of the caliber that Tottenham would want is obviously going to be very expensive, Mark. And I'm not that confident that they could necessarily afford to get one of their best targets in.
From what we hear, it doesn't sound like Daniel Levy wants to pay compensation for a manager, given Mark's point about paying off previous managers, and you're going to have to pay this new manager a really high salary. So ideally, you take somebody who is available in the summer and can slot in. And I'm sure there are names that haven't been mentioned that will be considered by Daniel Levy as well. If we extend it beyond the actual appointment of the manager, what about the finances to do what they need to do in the market? And I guess it's a question to both of you. Is what's going on at Tottenham a problem of the managers? Was it Jose Mourinho, or are we noticing something deeper here within the DNA and the makeup of the playing squad that span the end of the Pochettino era as well? It wasn't just the problems occurred under Mourinho's watch? And is a new manager going to need money to invest and rebuild that squad? Money that we're told is not really there, or can this squad rise up and excel in a way that they're not doing at the moment?
As I said before, this is why I mean, I think there has to be a reassessment of the expectations, because if you think of who are the names you associate with Tottenham over the past decade, okay, Lloris, Alderweireld, Vertonghen, he's gone, Alderweireld, Harry Winks, Dele Alli, Gareth Bale, Harry Kane, there's question marks over all these people now. In terms of their long-term future at Spurs, whether they've come to the end of a cycle, Eric Dier, another one, you know, questions over performance levels, over whether, you know, just that they're losing a bit of their, you know, what made them so exciting a few years ago. So this idea that some coach is going to come in and be able to launch a title challenge with this team seems completely ridiculous to me. But where I think it probably is an opportunity is if they sell Harry Kane. And that's the only way I can really see Spurs being able to fund a rebuild. But that also seems to be something that's completely unpalatable both to Daniel Levy and to the fan base. So I don't see where the money is to refresh this team without selling Harry Kane. But then I also don't see a market for Harry Kane this summer in terms of someone having the money out there to buy him. So I think they're caught in this real catch-22 where a new head coach is going to come in with a huge amount of expectation and, you know, pressure on him either to revitalise a playing squad that really seems quite tired, or to refresh a squad without the resources to do so. So I think I don't think it's anywhere near as appealing a job as it might have been when Jose Mourinho took over 18 months, 2 years, because they've invested a lot in that time. You know, they've blown a lot of money in that time as well. And that's why, you know, I think that's another reason beyond the finances, we don't want to pay compensation, that they would struggle anyway to get one of the real big name managers.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I do think it is a harder job now than it was when Mourinho took over. I think Adam's right that Kane could give them the opportunity to fund a whole new raft of players, but I think it's going to be a difficult market to sell anyone. Kane might be slightly different because if Manchester City or Manchester United miss out on Haaland, then maybe they would see Kane as, you know, obviously older than Haaland, but the best alternative. I think ideally, I think what Tottenham would probably rather do would be to sell players who aren't Kane and then use that money to rebuild.
Is there a market for Son,
who still hasn't signed a new contract?
I still think that will happen, even though it hasn't happened yet. I did a story at the start of the season back in October saying that the deal was very close. Obviously, it has been held up for months and months and months. I expect it will happen, but I can't see Tottenham selling him. I think ideally Spurs would rather sell their less good players to make money. Obviously, Daniel Levy always has high expectations of value when it comes to selling his players. But I don't think it's not going to be a seller's market this summer, you know, and that applies to players as much as it does to clubs who would want to sell. You know, you might well want to get rid of some mid-ranking players for 20, 30, 40 million pounds, but people aren't going to buy them. Nobody's got any money.
Certainly from what I'm hearing, you know, the sort of players they're looking at this summer aren't the kind of players that are going to radically transform them into, you know, towards the best teams in Europe again. You know, they're looking seriously at players like Joachim Andersson at Fulham and, you know, a good player, but he's not going to change their world in the way that Virgil van Dijk changed Liverpool's world.
No.
So, you know, again, I think we're now talking about a team that next season will be around sixth, fifth and fourth, whoever the coach is. I mean, I hope someone comes in and proves me wrong, but I can't see any other way really until the impact of the pandemic settles down a bit more from a financial point of view that it can be different.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Oh, Oliver Skipp, for example, has had a very good season on loan at Norwich. If you talk to Norwich fans, they've raved about him this season. And I know occasionally we've seen a couple of younger players that have come through the academy. Jack, you know, either on Mourinho made the point, didn't he, after one game? I can't remember which one it was, about the young players and the hunger that they had when you put them on the bench. And we saw some of them play against Marine in the FA Cup. Do they have players coming through to at least lift the mood a bit, as has happened? And Tottenham fans will probably hate me for using the comparison, but at least players like Smith Rowe, for example, or Martinelli or whatever, have lifted the mood a bit in difficult times at Arsenal. Do Tottenham have the same?
I always found that Mourinho loved to talk about the opportunities he would give young players while never really actually doing it. It reminded me a bit of when he was in Chelsea the second time around and he made a big show about talking about how much he'd use Ruben Loftus-Cheek. And then, of course, it never really worked out that way. And I think...
Well, of course, at Manchester United, he invented a whole new award just to give it to Scott McTominay one year at the end of the... Because he made on his own Scott McTominay, as we all know.
Spurs do have, you know, the answer is yes, they do have players like that. The two obvious ones would be Skip and Ryan Sessegnon, who's doing very well out on loan at Hoffenheim. And obviously Spurs spent a fair bit of money on back in 2019. He's not really made an impression in the Tottenham first team yet. I think a lot of that generation of players were waiting to see what would happen with Mourinho before deciding on their future. You know, you could argue that Skip would be better served by another season playing Premier League football with Norwich City next year rather than being on the bench for Tottenham. So it really depends on the new manager. And this is one of the reasons, I think, why Levy is so keen on someone who can work with young players, because, you know, the club's invested a fair bit in people like Skip, Sessegnon, Troy Parrott, who's done pretty well in League One at Ipswich Town in the last few months. And, you know, Spurs fans want to see these guys involved. Levy, I'm sure, would like to see these players involved, especially Sessegnon, because he was expensive. It remains to be seen who the manager is. And this is why there's this huge decision that Levy has to make. Does he go for a win-now manager like Mourinho, who probably won't play Skip and Sessegnon and Parrott? Or does he go for a kind of long-term builder who will involve those guys, even if it means not really pushing for top four anytime soon?
What about Devine and Scarlett? They are incredibly young, but don't look a million miles off, and very, very talented prospects.
No, I mean, I know they were, I think they were training pretty much full-time with Mourinho during his last few months. And certainly, I mean, Alfie Devine, who they took from Wigan, there was a huge amount of interest in him at the time as well. And I think, yeah, Mourinho went to his medical, which was a bit odd, but like went past to say hello. I think he was about 15 or 16 at the time when he joined the club. And then over the last few months, he's become involved. There was a big incident with Danny Drinkwater in an under-23 game between Devine and Drinkwater where they clashed. And I'm told Mourinho then pulled him aside the next day, basically to congratulate him on showing balls and character in this under-23 game against a seasoned pro like Danny Drinkwater. Yeah, I think they've got hopes for Devine, but again, I think he's 16, 17? And, we're pinning hopes here on players we've not really seen enough of. But that's what happens when Jose Mourinho leaves a club. As a fan base, you are left scratching around, wondering whether your players are good enough, wondering whether they still care about the club, wondering if they have the quality, because he's cast so much doubt over them for so long. And then you're pinning your hopes on these young players that you've not really seen, because that's the impression he leaves on a fan base at the very, very bitter end of his time at a club, however good the first part of his time can be. And you know, that's a familiar story from Chelsea, from Man United, and now from Spurs.
But if we sympathise with Levy for struggling through a pandemic, why aren't we saying the same for Mourinho, Jack, given that he has won wherever else he's been? And he didn't at Spurs, but they were quite rarefied circumstances.
The circumstances were tough. And, you know, I think he did pretty well to get them into sixth last year, given the unique circumstances of that first season. But if I were to mount a defence of Mourinho, I would say that he managed the fitness of the players through this season very well. You know, the players are clearly exhausted. They didn't really struggle with injuries that much. They kept playing to a fairly consistent level twice a week all the way through this season. And in terms of managing the fitness of the players, I think he did really, really well. But I just think that the problems that Mourinho brought in terms of the damage he did to the relationship with the dressing room and how he sapped the players of confidence, or a lot of the players of confidence, that is not connected to the COVID circumstances. So I don't think he gets a COVID pass on that particular count.
If Levy is patient and waits, more coaches will become available after the Euros, you would expect, wouldn't you? And that could then lead to some very interesting names being on the market, just to try and end on a positive for Tottenham fans who must be full of gloom after the last 25 minutes.
Roberto Martinez is a name that I've heard being pitched in connection with this job. Obviously, he's manager of Belgium at the moment. I imagine he'd want to return to club football after the Euros. I'm a big fan of Martinez. I think he'd do a really good job. He plays football the right way, and he, you know, seems to have a decent track record with young players. So in that sense, I think he'd tick a lot of the boxes, although I don't know whether all Spurs fans would agree with me.
He'd be a very good, he'd be very good Mourinho lozenge.
He would.
As well.
I think also, Martinez is like one of those coaches that, a bit, you know, a bit like Eddie Howe, one of those coaches that we sort of built up for about 10 years because he did a really good job for 10 years, wherever he was. And then he had, you know, one bad year or 18 bad months, and then we decided that he's absolutely useless, and now he's gone away and taken quite a smart job in the way that Brendan Rodgers did at Celtic as well. Just gently build yourself back up, recover your reputation, and now all of a sudden, you know, you have people looking at him thinking, you know, and I would think, you know, in the post-Bielsa Leeds days, if that was to be a year's time or something like that, that he would also be someone that they'd be very interested in. So that's not based on any information. That's just style of play and personality. Yeah. But I do, you know, and I do wonder, you know, Eddie Howe, I know people are talking with Celtic as well. If this conversation was 18 months ago, you know, he was being talked about very, very highly at Liverpool just before Jurgen Klopp. And we're in danger of forgetting some of these coaches that have been, you know, proven to be really good over an extended period of time in the Premier League and that can work with young players and develop a project.
But is Sean Dyche on this list?
I suspect not. I mean, you could see what he did in that one-off game at Wolves yesterday, and what more does he need to do to be considered for some of these jobs? And we know that there have been strong links to Crystal Palace, and I know he's one of the names they are considering if Roy Hodgson is to move on, but I don't think it would be one for Tottenham. Debate that all you like. And I mean, I don't mean to blow smoke up your backside, Mark, but whenever I've listened to Roberto Martinez on the radio with you, I've been absolutely captivated by him. And I think he would be a really good appointment. Just a personal preference. There's no insight there. I'm sure he'll be one of the names that Daniel Levy considers. And I do think Levy will be incredibly diligent with this appointment. We talk to people who have always explained to us how careful he is with signings and squad and contract decisions. And it doesn't always go right. But he will be going through this meticulously, statistically, and doing his work to make sure this is the right appointment. And yeah, it'd be interesting.
When he went in at Everton, he actually took over a squad that looked quite tired under David Moyes by the end. They'd had a decent final season, but it was a set of players that had been together quite long. It was that sort of base of Jagielka and Distan and Baines, wasn't it, at the back? And it was Tim Howard still in goal. And for the first 18 months or so, he did get an improvement out of them and an uptick in that performance. So I don't know if Tottenham will be the sort of rigorous enough to sort of go back and examine how that works when he went in with not a dissimilar, you know, set of players that have been together for quite a long time. But I do think he has shown an ability to improve performance levels from a set of players that have been together for a while. I mean, he's a fantastic interviewee, both from a journalistic but also from a chairman point of view. He will make promises to Daniel Levy. You know, I'm not saying they're in talks, but, you know, I think he promised Bill Kenwright, you know, we will get you in the Champions League. That was the promise that he made. And they came incredibly close that first season to doing so. So, we're in danger here of anointing him, but I do think he would make sense. I would say
we're going to talk Phil Foden with Sam in just a moment in our On the Plane feature. But I mentioned Arsenal before. I mentioned Emil Smith Rowe. You've got news of his contract in your column this week, David.
Yeah, Arsenal have worked really hard to renew the contracts of a number of their talented young players. If you think back to Bukayo Saka last summer, I think he was quickly followed by Gabriel Martinelli. Most recently, we've reported that they finally reached an agreement with Follerin Balogun. And the next one they want to tick off the list is Emile Smith Rowe, who's broken into the team, as we've seen since really, I think it was Boxing Day when he got into the side that faced Chelsea, beat Chelsea. And he's never looked back, apart from obviously a few injuries here or there, but he's been really influential. His contract expires in 2023. We've seen Arsenal publicly say in recent years they don't want players going into the last 2 years of their contract anymore. And so they've opened talks over a new long-term deal for him. I don't have any more detail than that at this stage, but they'll obviously hope to retain him. He's come through their academy system. We're approaching a point of some massive decisions for Arsenal. That's one of the easier ones. They know they want to retain him. Do they want to retain David Luiz, whose contract expires this summer? What are they going to do in the case of Martin Odegaard? They want a number 10, but can they afford him from Real Madrid, or do they have to look elsewhere? And will he go back to the Bernabeu from his loan spell? Danny Ceballos, also of Real Madrid. Matt Ryan on loan from Brighton. That's not such a major consideration. The returning Matteo Guendouzi and Lucas Torreira, what's going to happen on those fronts? Finally, they released the financial shackles of Mesut Ozil, who I report in the column today. Arsenal are still paying him more than 90% of his weekly wage, £350,000 a week, until the end of June. So that's coming towards an end.
That is extraordinary. So they've been paying him 90% of his wages to play elsewhere. I mean, it shows how desperate by the end all parties must have been for him to be elsewhere, but particularly Arsenal.
Yeah, and we said at the time that it was not a financial decision. In the end, it was just that Arsenal wanted to move on from him, and Edu, the technical director, was kind of hailed for managing to agree that deal in terms of getting him to Fenerbahce, making him happier to play his football, making Arsenal happier not to have an unhappy player in the camp. But with many of these things, and we don't know the exact terms of these sort of severance agreements that take place at a number of clubs, it's just about getting bodies out of the building for many of the Premier League clubs and having a more streamlined, cordial club, you could say. And Arsenal will have to reassess how they approach those contract situations going forward. We also mentioned in the column that they've got Richard Garlick coming in from the Premier League. He's, you could say, a victim of the last week and the Super League situation, because he was due to join Arsenal, but he was working out a notice period at the Premier League. He's now left with immediate effect after the recent events. And I think he'll join Arsenal at the end of, or slightly before the end of the season. And he, one of his primary roles is to work on managing contracts for the first team. That's absolutely critical for Arsenal going forward. And they have the opportunity to raise quite a lot of money. If you think of players who have been linked with moves away, the likes of Hector Bellerin, Torreira, Guendouzi, Reece Nelson, rumours around Eddie Nketiah, Alexander Lacazette. Some people have suggested to me that Arsenal have the potential to raise more money this summer than most clubs. And then it's a case of how it will be reinvested. Are they going to recruit a right-sided centre-back like we've reported before, back up in the full-back positions, maybe a midfielder, striker if one of them leaves? So I keep saying this every week about clubs, huge summer ahead, but it really is for Arsenal, and so much will depend on the outcome of their Europa League campaign. I mean, up against Unai Emery is sort of poetic, really.
Okay, now on the pod, time for On the Plane, our weekly feature with the illogical title that looks at how the England squad is shaping up ahead of Euro 2020. This week, our focus on just one man. That's Manchester City's Phil Foden. We're joined by Sam Lee, our City writer. He's first name on the City team sheet at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, he just gives them so much. Like, and this was what fans were crying out for earlier in the season when things weren't going quite so well. But even now, they found their rhythm, and you know, as Guardiola says, it's 1,000 passes and they're strangling games, as we saw against Villa last week and Spurs on Sunday. Even when they're playing so well, he can take the ball, swivel, beat two or three men and then carry the ball 15, 20 yards up the pitch before you've even realised what's happened. And yeah, he gives them so much on the pitch, and he's a threat in front of goal, goals or assists. He's, you know, whatever they do between now and the end of the season, Champions League-wise, he's going to be huge for that.
It was a remarkable bit of footage in the warm-up yesterday. I don't know whether you saw this, Sam, of he's basically just juggling the ball whilst walking, whilst sort of trotting along the pitch. He's looking here, there and everywhere, but the ball never drops. It hits his shoulder, hits his head, flicks it up. What I thought was most remarkable is just how relaxed he looks, and he has that demeanour in every game as well. That's not just during a warm-up.
By all accounts, you know, working on articles with him and speaking to people who know him, he's always got the ball at his feet, just around the house, just relentlessly kicking it around. So obviously he's been at City for probably about 15 years and he's only 20.
There was that footage, wasn't there, as well, with him, with his mates in the street?
Yeah, just always playing.
Always with a ball.
And he, especially even when he was like 17, 18, so still a part of the City squad, but not as big as he is now, he would, you know, go and play with mates or, you know, dad's mates or whatever, just playing all the time. And I just think it's that fact that he's so comfortable with it, but he does it so often. And I think just he's been around this City team for 4 or 5 years now, since he was, you know, a young lad, 16 years old, going into that dressing room, basically with the mentality, although as obviously the best player in the academy, he probably would have been going into that dressing room like a fan, seeing Aguero and David Silva and company and that kind of thing. But over the last 3 or 4 years with how he's been managed, that's just become completely normal to him. Guardiola's always said, you know, he's not getting favours because he's local or come through the academy or whatever. He's good enough. So I guess that just helps to take everything in his stride. But the fact that he's been playing football like that every day for about 15 years at the age of 20, and just the fact that he's just completely surrounded by all these greats and he's just so used to it, like nothing fazes him.
Sam, the one thing I noticed about him the most yesterday is that he used to take quite a peripheral role in City's play, like a really impressive role, lovely touches, link up play, etc. But when he played, he wasn't kind of like integral to what they were doing. Now, everywhere I look, he's going to take the ball, almost like David Silva used to. He is exerting his authority. He's ramming into players. Like he's actually built himself up to be really strong. He's toying with them when he's got the ball at his feet, like in that video clip we've seen. We're now seeing it in real life. It seems like he is coming into a leadership role on the pitch for Man City. And yeah, I'm going to overhype it here. I don't think I've seen a more naturally talented English player on the big stage. I'm thinking to the likes of obviously Gazza and Wilshere, etc. And I'm not comparing him to them. I'm just saying that like he is a unique player.
He's just so clean, isn't he? And it goes back to what Chappers was saying. It's the technique. The technique is it's just flawless, really. But then obviously to be able to do that in the game, because you know how many freestylers do you see who are amazing, but they don't play in the Premier League. But Foden's got all that; he's got all the skills. But on the pitch, he doesn't do a load of stepovers. He doesn't do all the tricks that he can do. Because I think he's probably the best, you know, freestyler in the City squad. But you'd never see that from looking at him. He does that thing where he stands a player up and he waits and he takes little steps and he moves his body and he tries to make them lose balance. And as soon as they've lost balance, he darts off the other way. And that's how he gets past people. I think there was a game earlier in the season. I think it was Michael Owen. And he said, well, there was all sorts of comparisons going around, but Messi was mentioned in terms of how he gets past players without, because Messi doesn't do a load of stepovers or tricks like Ronaldinho would do. And that's where those comparisons come in, because yeah, that technique's just so clean. And in terms of that leadership role on the pitch, there's that bravery, again, another all the comparisons today, but in the way that Iniesta would always take the ball, you know, little guy, but he'd always take the ball and not be scared to get it. He's got that. Now he needs to get trusted a bit more.
To me, that's what stands out the most about Foden. It's that we've obviously seen lots of very talented English players in the past, but I don't quite remember seeing an English player who just has that same sort of slipperiness or wriggliness that Foden has. Like his capacity to get the ball in a tight space surrounded by 3 or 4 opponents and then just to wriggle his way through them is something which is not really very characteristic of English players. You know, I can't really think of a good example. You might say possibly Joe Cole, for example, or Gazza. That's why people call him Skinfade Gascoigne. But I can't, and that I think is what makes him so unique as well. And that is obviously connected to the incredible technical ability. And one of the things that I enjoy most about watching Foden is every time I watch him play, he does something new that I've never seen him do before, whether it's a certain touch or a skill or a way of hitting the ball or a way of getting past an opponent. Yeah, he even to people who watch him a lot, he has a capacity to surprise you, which is really why we all watch football in the first place. So yeah, he's just been better and better.
Adam, the way he almost led the assault and the waves of attack with some sort of swagger and I'm going to drive this forward against an obdurate defence that was holding out for so long. When I was watching him yesterday, I thought, I wonder if he is now in possession of a starting role for England, in a sense that England might find themselves against a lot of opposition having to do that. And he almost looks tailor-made for it. And we've said on here in previous weeks about Mount being a nailed-on starter and Rice and Henderson, et cetera, et cetera. But talk about playing yourself into form.
No, I think you're right. And this is why, you know, when we were talking about Mount a few weeks ago, and I was just saying, you know, it might be okay if he doesn't start every single game because we have lots of really, really talented players. I think quite an interesting thing that's developing is obviously with Sterling's situation at Manchester City. Does that translate into England starting places in the summer? Foden's clearly overtaken Sterling, I think, at City at the moment. Does Gareth Southgate feel the same way? But then you have to think in terms of styles of play. Well, are England going to have as much of the ball as Manchester City usually do, and how does that impact the way that Phil Foden is able to influence a game? Does it mean that he's left, you know, I suppose, Jack, like a little bit like Joe Cole used to be at times with England, where you have this fantastic technical player on the pitch, but the team's playing in a style that doesn't necessarily bring the best out of him. And I know we said that about so many players with England over the years, but this is why it becomes a huge challenge for Gareth Southgate, because he's got some immensely technically gifted players now, and is he a coach that's capable of devising in a very, very short space of time now a system that can maximise the talents of Grealish and Mount and Sancho and Rashford and Kane and Foden, all these fantastic players who to me seem really well suited to a possession-based style, but I'm not sure if that was what Gareth Southgate will do in the summer.
I wonder whether Guardiola's decision to move Foden into wide area basically over the last year or so has actually been very good for Southgate, because Foden started the last two games against Albania and Poland in the last international break playing in a wide role, meaning that it wasn't a choice between Foden or Mount because they both played with Sterling on the other side and Harry Kane up front. And I imagine that the England team that starts against Croatia in June will look quite a lot like that. You know, maybe you'd have Rashford in for Sterling. I don't imagine you'd have Grealish. Maybe you'd have Sancho in, but I don't think so. So I do think Foden and Mount can work together. And to be honest, I'm sure, you know, people always used to talk about Foden as a midfielder, but I think that wide position is actually works out really well for him. It gets him 1v1 against players. He can take people on. He can run in behind because he's quicker than he looks. And I think maybe that's the answer.
And if he is wide, Sam, that he's ahead of Sterling at club level, so you would assume that wide lefty, or you know, wide of a front three, however you want to do it, he could be ahead of Sterling at international level. I think Rashford at the moment can be very hit and miss, really. So you would argue that he's probably ahead of Rashford as well. And Grealish isn't fit at the moment. So if you are looking at him in a wide role or part of a front three or whatever, he's ahead of all his competitors, isn't he?
I suppose so, in those circumstances. And the thing with Rashford, it always seems to pick up a knock on like a Thursday night, and they think he's never going to play at the weekend. Then he does, and he picks up another knock. He just keeps playing. So you wonder and you hope that they don't catch up with him. But I mean, yeah, if you're comparing it to those kind of players, then you would say he's first choice. And yeah, like Jack was saying, he's just so clinical and dangerous up front. Like it's a bit of a masterstroke from Guardiola, really. And part of it is because Guardiola, he's already got one type of Foden player in that midfield, and he doesn't want to. He always wants one player like Gundogan or David Silva just to kind of sit and control the game, get the ball and give the ball and pass it off and let the others kind of dribble and carry it forward and search. He doesn't want two De Bruyne's. And unfortunately for Foden, that's why he's not playing in midfield, because they've already got one. But the beauty of it is he's just put him in the forward line. And all these abilities we're talking about, they just fit perfectly. And all Phil's youth coaches, they talk about, oh yeah, you know, he'll go back into midfield one day. And I mean, maybe he will. And you know, if De Bruyne moves on in a couple of years, or in a few years, and Phil's still there, then he could probably do that. But why? Like, it's working out so well for him. The amount of goals he's got already. there's no reason he couldn't do it, and yet he's just got that ability to arrive in space like a lot of midfielders have, you know, for the cutback goals that City are so good at getting. But as we talked about already, he can drive forward and create stuff as well. But the goal I'm looking forward to him scoring, and he came close to doing it in the last two games, you know, when he's got the ball in the box and he just can't get it off him. It's like that. He's got that skin you in a phone box kind of vibe about it. He's taking 1,000 different touches and they can't get it off him. And he'll bounce one off Gundogan. And then it just seems to be somebody gets a deflection on it. But one day he's going to dance around everyone in that box and score a fantastic goal. And yeah, they should keep him in the front three, I think. Certainly short term. But yeah, the problem with England is, are they going to play like City do? And the answer is probably not. But they've certainly got the players to do something different, at least.
David, do you think he's been fully forgiven by Southgate for what happened in Iceland? Do you think he's past that point, doesn't care, is it over?
Yeah, I do. I think it's completely banished, but very much not absent from the mind of Southgate. Discipline and respect, behaviour is really important, and it's one of the factors he will have undoubtedly considered in the recent party incident where James Maddison was, etc. We've seen Mason Greenwood was involved on the Iceland front. Kyle Walker had some issues early in lockdown.
We might be here a while if we go.
Harry Maguire, Jordan Pickford. Yeah, I'm going through the entire squad now. But with Southgate, it's very much how they respond to it. And with many of those players I listed, they've responded really well. From what we heard at the time and we reported it, Foden had shown immediate contrition and Southgate was taking soundings from him back at Manchester City and was really impressed. I think there was a bit of a rough period with Mason Greenwood, which he thankfully seems to have emerged through. He signed a new contract. Things are moving in the right direction. I wish him really well too. But Foden, I've heard absolutely no concerns about from the England camp since that incident. I was reading a James Ducker piece about how he just sits there in his room these days doing sticker albums. He's absolutely obsessed with football, and Sam's written so much about him on that level as well. And back on the football front, and I don't know who wants to answer this, Mark, perhaps, even as the slightly more senior statesman who's seen much more of England than all of us and the problems they've encountered over the years.
I don't know if we have a bleep machine on this, but David.
You're older. What was I meant to say? Like, I didn't know how to phrase that. You're older and more experienced than us.
Go on then. Yeah.
That was factually correct. And it was, I was sort of trying to be complimentary, made a bad job of it. We've talked for so many years about an England player to unpick a defence. Sam mentioned it there about, you know, the post box analogy. Do we finally have this player that we've all been searching for so long, if England play the right way?
Well, if all I could think of right at the very start when everybody was eulogising about him, and Sam in particular, about what he's done at Manchester City was, that absolutely guarantees that he will start on the bench for England. I mean, you've just seen it so many times before with the game changer. But what I would say, in having watched England for a very long time, as you point out, David, going all the way back to 1982, I can't think of a time when Southgate has had more potential game changers, I would say. And the final thing, just to round it all off, is I would say to Sam, it's almost as if Phil Foden didn't need 6 months on loan at Derby to toughen him up, or wherever else he could have gone. I've just picked Derby at random. But it does prove that every player needs to be treated differently.
Yeah, like City never wanted him to go on loan. No. And he didn't either. He always, you know, he and his advisors always felt, what's the point in, you know, even 20, 30 games in a team where the system doesn't suit him? They wanted him to learn at City where it suits him. And I think that was always obvious. There was always a clamour for him to play, but I always felt he's just learning exactly what he needs to do. The only way he can learn to play for Manchester City is at Manchester City, yeah, just because of how specific Guardiola plays his football. It was the only way it could be done. And now we're seeing the fruits of that.
More on the plane on next week's pod and over on the Athletic's YouTube channel. Thank you to everybody, to Jack and Sam and Adam for being with us. And if my nurses let me, I'll be back on Thursday with the Business of Sport podcast. Thanks for listening.
Mark, I owe you a pint, young man.
The Athletic.